Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Libyan-British writer Hisham Mattar, whose two novels, In the Country of Men and Anatomy of Disappearance, were inspired by his true life story, the family's exile from Libya under Gaddafi, and the subsequent kidnapping and disappearance of his father, Gaddafi opposition leader Jabala Mattar. Mattar was a finalist for the Man Booker Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and his latest book is a poignant memoir, which tells the story of the author and his family, the fruitless search for his father after the Gaddafi regime fell, and his subsequent reuniting with country and extended family in the book, which is titled The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. It's published by Random House. He's a guest of the University of Tulsa Creative Writing Program and will be speaking and reading from the book tonight at 7 in the university's Terrell Hall Auditorium. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Hisham Mattar, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your new book, the New York Times said it's not quite right to call it a memoir, although it is a memoir because it's so much more. And it was a really glowing review of the book, The Return. But it's about your return to Libya in 2012 after your family was exiled and left Libya because your family was very much involved in the opposition to the Gaddafi regime. How difficult was it to go back to Libya in 2012?
It was complicated in the sense that there were things about it that were difficult. There were things about it that were easy. It was easy to fall back into the embrace of the family, the extended family, and also the land. You know, the landscape is so part of my childhood that it was, you know, just delightful to be back in it. But it was difficult because, you know, something happens that, you know, the assumption is that when you leave a place, when you can no longer return to your country, you're waiting to go back. And the assumption is that in that time, you remain somewhat the same and the place remains somewhat the same. And the fantasy is that the two will be reunited and all will be well. But what ends up happening actually is that you're changed and the place has changed. So in my case, 33 years later, in that time, so much has changed, and I had to acquire new skills, as we all do, no? I had to acquire new language. I had to find ways to live without my country, find ways to live without seeing the people that, you know, I love and grew up with. And so when I was going back, it felt strangely dangerous because I might lose those skills that I've cultivated.
Well, and you write so lovingly of the land itself, of the sea. I think there's a passage where I think when Gaddafi fell, I think your brother was swimming, I believe, in the went swimming on the Libyan coast, and you were swimming in the south of France. And it's the same sea, but it says this was not my sea. My sea was off of Tripoli.
Yes, no, it was a memory of my father teaching me how to swim. In Tripoli and me swimming in the south of France and same sea, you're right. But something about, I don't think it is unique to the Libyan landscape. I think the Libyan landscape is undoubtedly beautiful and magical on so many levels. But I think what I'm writing about is something that happens to all of us. There's a moment when you are a child, maybe it happens when you're five or so, when suddenly you realize that, yes, of course, you are part of a family and a society and a country and a story. And like the rest of us, we're all born into these stories. But there's something that's just essentially you, something slightly different. And you come to terms with that when you're a young kid. And I think wherever that happens, your relationship to the landscape, where that happens, is so resonant. It's filled with memories of that.
Right. And I think everybody can share that. But if you leave that land and come back, say even if it's 50 miles away, you know, Americans, we move all
Absolutely.
The time, right?
Absolutely.
And when you go back, you have this sort of memory, but very seldom does it ever match up with that memory. Did you have the same experience?
Absolutely. And I think because the distance in my case is so long, and it was my memories of Libya were made more feverish by the fact that I was not allowed to go back. It was complicated for me to go back, forbidden to go back. And nothing sweetens memory more than forbidden. So I was, all of that was very much I was charged with all of that.
Of course, the memoir is much more than just coming back to Libya. It's really about the relationship with your father, who was actually abducted. He was out of Libya, living in Cairo, and abducted with the collusion of the Egyptian government, taken back to Libya, imprisoned for a number of years. His fate remains absolutely uncertain, but for the most part, it is thought that he is dead at this point. He was a resolute enemy of the Gaddafi regime. The Gaddafi regime treated him as such, and that complicates this relationship as well. And a father who's out of your life for so long.
Yes, absolutely. So the absence at the heart of my life really is takes place when I was 19. You know, it's very complicated when you lose somebody to disappearance because you don't really, your sense of the possibility of them existing at exactly this minute is a real, and at times at least, seemed a very reasonable possibility. And so it colors all the, you know, the quality of your hours. And also, it's complicated. So it's not like when you say, it's complicated if you'd say, my father died. That's also complicated. But people, you know, your friends, particularly when you're young, might pussyfoot around it and find it a little bit uneasy, as we all do around grief. But we know what that is, right? Or we think we do. But with disappearance, it confuses people and also makes them feel a little bit helpless. And so as a response to this, I kept it very, very private. I just didn't tell anyone, hardly anyone, any of my friends. And so that absence, then, as you have said, you know, then, you know, we know after the revolution and the prisoners that were released and many people were accounted for, there is still a large body of the disappeared in Libya, political prisoners who have vanished. And just through the laws of deduction, you know that they're dead, but you don't know exactly how, where, all of these things. So that is very much one of the you know, it's the central silent motor behind my return and looking not only for a vivid, real relationship with my country in the present, not on the past, but also looking for my father.
Your father was an amazing man. You describe him in the book as a man who, it's hard to imagine him ever bending. There's all this imagery of resolute, straight-backed, just absolutely resolute in whatever he did. He was an army officer. Once Gaddafi took over, he left the military and was a diplomat for a while. And perhaps at one point he was looking at saying, hey, this might be a positive for Libya, but that was quickly crushed as Gaddafi became an autocrat.
Yeah.
Okay. And then became an opponent of the regime.
Yeah.
Eventually, you had to leave Libya, and you settled in Cairo. It was really interesting. You tell the story. As I was reading this early part of the book, I was saying, as I remember it, the Libyan secret police, they were kind of like, you know, they were the fodder for Hollywood movies, you know, because they were always doing operations well outside its borders, executing dissidents around the world, really.
Yes, absolutely.
So this was a very dangerous time for your family.
It was. It was a very dangerous time. And at the same time, we sort of never spoke about it. You know, families, I think, have a particular genius for doing that. Like, you know, all families suffer something incredibly central, but hardly ever speak about it. I think that's why literature is filled with families. So, yes, we never spoke about it. And also there was a kind of an adamant, almost sort of stubbornness on my father's side not to let the threats stop us from doing anything that we wanted to do. So, for example, when my brother and I thought it would be, you know, adventurous to go study in boarding schools in Europe, he let us. And there were risks associated, and we had to, in my case, I had to go under a different name.
Yeah, you were under an assumed name.
Yeah.
You were Robert.
I was called Robert. Well, I wanted to be called Bob because I like Bob Dylan and Bob Marley. And I thought it would be nice to be called Bob, but I ended up being called Robert. It wasn't as interesting.
And I guess there was actually an attempt to kidnap your brother at one point?
Yes. I don't know. Actually, you know, in hindsight, I describe it exactly how I remember it. But in hindsight, you know, you pause and think, well,
Were they tailing him?
They came this close. It would have been very easy. If they really wanted to do it, they probably would have been able to do it. Maybe it was more to sort of, you know, scare us.
Intimidate you.
Intimidate my father. And they were using a lot of tactics to, you know, like they did with all of their opponents. You know, they intimidate you, buy you. They can't buy you or intimidate you. Then they get rid of you. You know, those are the steps. And that's what happened to my father.
Your father, Jabala, was leading an opposition. And what you found once you returned was that you thought of him as being in exile. He was actually going into Libya to see his father.
Secretly, yes. I think he made two or three trips. He would dress in the clothes of an Egyptian farmer and with clandestine papers, make his way through the border to go just to see his father, my grandfather. He would sit with him in the middle of the night for a couple of hours when everyone else was asleep and then make his way back.
Yeah.
And I think loved his father. It was very, they had a very strong, very strong relationship. And, it was interesting for me. You know, the book is called The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. And that subtitle is really there because there are many different fathers and sons in this book, not just me, obviously, and my father.
You're also your uncle, Mahmoud, who was also in prison for many years. In fact, many members of your family. I mean, your father was imprisoned, it was the whole Matar clan almost.
Yes, my several members of my paternal family were involved in the resistance against the dictatorship. And so when they were arrested at the same moment. Two uncles, two cousins, and my father. But they were arrested in such a way that none of them knew that the others were arrested. They assumed they were the only ones. And so everybody else was arrested inside Libya. My father was the only one who was kidnapped from outside Libya. And so the others were put in the same wing, and they eventually came to know of one another's presence in the prison. And very slowly they learned of my father's presence. And I write about this because my father could have disclosed his identity to them sooner, but he chose not to. And then when he decided to speak to them, so they're in one wing, and in that wing, the wing is full. Everybody knows everybody, they talk to each other and so on. There's another wing opposite that is empty. There's only one cell that seems to have someone in it because the door, they would hear the door open and close at certain moments. And at night, in my Uncle Mahmoud's words, he said when the prison would fall so silent that you could hear a pin drop or a grown man weep softly to himself, you would hear this steady, passionate voice of a man. They thought a voice belonged to a very elderly man in the opposite wing, reciting poetry. And my father had a library of
and, you know, and that recitation was sort of a part of your growing up, too. I mean,
yes,
at family meals or big social events, he would recite
poetry.
The
sweetest moment for me as a boy is after these crazy long dinners that my parents had, which were fun, but, you know, for a child, not so interesting. There will come a moment when my father will be urged by the company to recite something. And he really, you know, it was difficult to find any significant poet, particularly the modernists. He had a thing for the modernists. Any significant modernist Arabic poet that my father didn't know a handful of poems by heart. So he would do that. So that was, you could say, that's the first gesture of him wanting to disclose something of his presence.
Do you think, as I was reading that passage, I was thinking he probably recognizes family members.
Yes.
But he's unsure if they're being coerced, you know, if they're if not necessarily colluding with the regime, but they're being coerced to sort of get him to reveal something. Or, you know, unsure of the intentions of the other members of his families.
Yes, I mean, there are so many possibilities, aren't there?
Because it takes weeks for him to finally reveal. And your uncle said he never recognized the voice.
Didn't recognize the voice. And so I write about that. I try to examine the possible motivations, right? Like you and I are doing now. Because I think part of what happens in the fate of at least my relationship with what happened to my father is, or what might have happened to my father, is that every time I find a new piece of information, it excites more questions, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of the you know, it occupies your imagination this in ways that are very hard to sustain. And one of the things that I was trying to do in the book is write about that, but also write about the other things, the quieter things that such an urgent fate made it complicated for me to engage with, such as literature and paintings. The life of the mind, you know, difficult. You know, if you're a child like me who is interested in art and literature, and who, you know, when I see a barrier, this was the joke when I was a kid, it's like, put a barrier in front of Hisham and he doesn't think about getting over it. He asks, why is the barrier there? Who put the barrier? Why did they put the barrier? So if you're that sort of child, then under a situation of, you know, extreme political urgency, people disappearing, massacres, you know, assassinations, very dramatic activity, and also being part of what they call in the Middle East a political home, you know, where you have dinners of people talking about politics and what to do next and activism and men of action, right? So, you know, if that's the situation, it makes it complicated and less permissible to talk about the things that you're interested in, notwithstanding the fact that it was a loving, generous family. Still, you know. So the book then becomes a space for not only for memory and history and politics and so on, but also for my own personal consciousness, you know, for my own thoughts and responses to the world.
My guest today is Hisham Mattar. He's a novelist, two acclaimed novels, and his latest book is a nonfiction story of the return, his return to Libya after the fall of Gaddafi and the search for his father. It's called The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. And you alluded to the fact this is more than one father and one son. You renewed your acquaintance, and your acquaintance had been on and off with your uncle Mahmoud, but he spent 21 years imprisoned as well. And his son, Izzo, turned out to be a part of the revolutionary force that brought down the Gaddafi regime. There's another father and son relationship,
yes,
where one did not know really the other very well.
Yes. I mean, Izzo was a toddler when Uncle Mahmoud was arrested. And when Uncle Mahmoud eventually returns home, they spent, I think, maybe 6 weeks together in the same house. It's the only time that Izzo had with his father, as an adult, you know, with his father, and sleeping under the same roof. And then the revolution broke. You know, humorously, Uncle Mahmoud said to me, you know, it's a wonderful revolution, but it doesn't have very good manners. It could have just left us a bit more time before, you know. And so Izzo then becomes very involved in the struggle against the Gaddafi forces, and you know he loses his life in this. So the book does have different portraits of fathers and sons, maybe also not only because for the reasons we've spoken about, because this relationship is so central to my life, but I think whenever you come to write about a country at a particular moment, or when you write about fathers and sons, you're really writing about other things, you know. So much involved there, isn't there, with memory and time, different interpretations of reality, different desires running in different directions, you know. One towards the past, one towards the future, and so on. So it's quite an interesting
literature setup. Is built on fathers
absolutely.
And sons, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
Fathers and sons, and whether they follow, they rebel,
yeah.
they
yeah.
reconcile, they families yeah. fall apart.
And also, what is the complex distance between what is contained in our chests and what is expressed, right? It's like that wonderful moment in Hamlet when his mother tells him basically, you know, get over it, you know. Your father died, it's, you know, people die, this is the way of the world, it's common, she says to him. And he says to her, he agrees, he says, yes, it is common. She says, yeah, but it seems particular with thee. He says, seems, madam, no, it is, I know not seems. And then he goes into that lovely string of 'tis not only my inky cloak, good mother, nor my customary suit of solemn black, nor the fruitful river in the eye. And these things are, he says, for a man to play, you know, these things that what is shown. But I have within me that which passeth shows, you know. So that distance to me is what has always been fascinating about the history of literature and about being involved in trying to write anything. And also what is interesting to me about being a human being, that, you know, there's this wonderful space between the unutterable, right? The way that you feel about the dearest, closest people to you, the way you feel doesn't exist in language. You feel it in a way that then you must translate through deeds and words and so on. And literature is interested in this gap. And in a sense, my book is about that distance, you know.
Another obvious influence is Telemachus shows up all the time. Yeah. Odysseus' son, yeah. The Odyssey, yeah. Who, again, is trying to understand a father that is absent.
Yes, there was a line from the Odyssey when Telemachus says, "I wish I had a happy man for father, growing old in his home, right. But unknown death and silence are his fate." And this line remained with me for a long time. You know, it was some like a, I don't know, like an inner refrain,
so when,
really.
When you first read that at boarding school, I mean, did that have resonance for you then?
I read it after, I mean, I'm sure I read the Odyssey at school. I just don't remember it. Yeah. But I read it after, you know, after I lost my father at university, for whatever reason. I forget why I read it, but that line somehow clung to me, went into one of my pockets and never left. And throughout the years, its meaning altered and changed. In the beginning, it was really the obvious wish of any son, or most sons, to see their fathers grow old in the comfort and dignity of their own home. Who doesn't want that, right? So in the beginning, it was about the father, the son's wish for the father. But with time, and I try to reflect that in the book, its meaning expanded for me. And it became also the wish for Telemachus himself to have his father home so as he could get on with things, he could go and leave the house, right? Because that's also the other complicated injustice involved in disappearance, is that it ties the family up in some way, you know, the individuals up in some way that are very, very complicated and subtle to measure. And again, that's one of the things that I try to engage with.
Yeah. Yeah. As the Gaddafi regime sort of reacquainted itself in the Western world in the early 2000s, it sort of came to an understanding with the British government, where you were living at the time. And what's really interesting about this memoir is that there's, I don't want to say a dispassionate moment, but it's very subdued as far as there's sort of passion beneath the words. But the tone of the book is seemingly dispassionate, except for a couple of lines when Saif al-Islam, who is one of Gaddafi's sons, after the sort of resumption of relations between Libya and Britain, he moves to Hampstead. And he said, "It was all I could do to keep from getting a gun and going to his house and shooting him." And eventually you have some contact with him and trying to find out about your father. And really, he said, in hindsight, he was telling you he was dead. Without him saying it directly, I think you and your brother just did not want to understand that. That must have been very difficult.
Well, you know, I'm not particularly proud of that thought. I mean, there are things in the book that I'm not particularly proud of. Yeah. But, you know, I've never, one of the few things that I felt really, that sort of reassured me during the worst times, is that I have never fantasized about exacting, you know, the same
revenge,
actions, right, on mm-hmm. the perpetrators. Never, ever fantasized about the torture, being tortured. I mean, that seems to me, that is the genuine defeat, that the oppressor brings you into the logic of his thinking, and that's the sort of becomes your grammar, right? So I was always aware of that. But there are moments when I slipped, you know, in my thinking, in my imagination. But yes, my engagements with Saif al-Islam were really try to extract information from him about the fate of my father, and more importantly, in the bigger picture, to get him to advance on certain issues of human rights infringements in Libya against, you know, the kind of the new love affair that was happening between Libya and America, and Libya and Britain, Libya and France and Italy, basically the whole Western world at that time, and also oblige the British government to measure their new dealings with their new friendship with Libya against these advancements. So that was the bigger context, and we had a campaign and lots of people were involved. And in that, I had several direct engagements with Saif al-Islam. And he was saying, he knows but can't tell me. He knows what happened to my father, and he can't tell me. And I was saying, you know, there's nothing that I am willing to do here for you to tell me. In other words, I'm not going to surrender any part of my position. So this was the game between us. I was trying to get him to move on these things and so fulfill on his the PR picture he was creating with the help of American PR companies and British PR companies, that he is the reformer, that Libya has changed, that Gaddafi is a...
And he wanted you to come home.
And he wanted me to come back.
That as a symbol of the regime
as
changing.
Part of the PR game, yeah, absolutely. And so this was the very delicate and tough, you know, it was very, very tough to remain, you know, sober. And I remember at that time learning from a friend of mine who's an international lawyer that under international law, disappearance is equal to torture. But here's the genius of the law. It's not only equal to torture of the person who's been made to disappear and their families, of course, but also to the person who was ordered to disappear, the person who was, right? So it's incredibly complex. And I felt at those moments when Saif al-Islam was saying, I know what happened to your father, but I can't tell you. It's the closest I got to being tortured, you know. You know, because it's a maddening situation, right? How do you? And also, it was an important step in the longer journey for me to do with discovering, to my complete surprise, I have to admit, that there's really nothing this guy can give me that would take away anything of substance or add anything of substance. Of course, it's important to know what happened to my father, and it's our right as a family to know where he is, and you know, to have our funeral. Right? These are important things. It's our human right. But my father is available to me in ways far more immediate than all of this business. So I also discovered that looking for him, the obsessive nature of my search for my father, was also veiling other possibilities of how to hold him in my memory, how to engage with him. This was a wonderful discovery. I didn't, you know, it wasn't so much doing the book that led me to that. It was part of a long series of many events and years. But I have to admit, it has changed. It has informed my understanding of the nature of memory. And I feel that my father is much closer, much more available to me than before when I was, you know, obsessing about where he is.
Hisham Matar, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Writer Hisham Matar speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His novels include In the Country of Men and Anatomy of Disappearance. His latest book is a memoir, The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. It's published by Random House. He'll be speaking and reading tonight as a guest of the University of Tulsa Creative Writing Program at 7 o'clock, the university's Terrell Hall Auditorium, and that reading is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.